Hi, my name is Billy, and today I'll be reading you USA Today for the Talking Information Center. This version of USA Today comes from Tuesday, February 17th, 2026. And over to our first article. Interest in state laws over ICE rises. Block or help depends on the party in charge. This was written by Trevor Hughes. State lawmakers across the country are ramping up efforts to either support or block the Trump administration's mass deportation efforts, wading deeper into a policy arena that's long been the province of the federal government. While immigration enforcement is a federal power, states have many opportunities to either smooth the way or throw up roadblocks, particularly when it comes to being a sanctuary jurisdiction. Lawmakers from across the political spectrum said the attention focused on immigration by President Donald Trump and being executed by Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers has created a significant appetite for state-level action. In Republican-led states, White House officials have been working with legislative leaders to target sanctuary jurisdictions where local police won't cooperate with immigration officers. They are also pushing state lawmakers to expand 287G programs, allowing local police to take on limited immigration enforcement authority and requiring local sheriffs to hold onto suspected unauthorized immigrants until immigration enforcers can collect them from jail. Republican states like Florida and Texas have long had expansive 287G programs, and the two states have for years collaborated with the federal government on immigration, in part because of their proximity to Mexico and the Gulf of America, also known as the Gulf of Mexico. But now, other non-border states are increasingly wading in, many of them led by Democrats, pushing plans to bar ICE officers from wearing a anonymizing face mask, allowing residents to sue officers in state court over civil rights violations, and further limit cooperation by local police and sheriffs. Here are some of the proposals being considered as state legislators begin their sessions. Republican states collaborating. In Tennessee, Republican leaders have worked with the White House to craft a package of bills aimed at cutting off any state's spending on unauthorized residents, in part by creating immigration checks for public school children. Under federal law, all children in the United States are entitled to a free public education, and migrant rights groups say efforts to track citizenship might scare immigration children into staying home. The plans would also permit state and local police to detain truckers who can't immediately prove their lawful status and stop offering driver's license tests in any language but English. Tennessee House leaders said they have consulted with Stephen Miller, the White House Deputy Chief of Staff, on how to make their proposals most effective. It's about making sure that those who are here legally, lawfully, have access to the things they need to have access to and not be detrimental by the illegals coming in and doing that, House Speaker Cameron Sexton said. For instance, the United States has a limited supply of public housing, Sexton said, and it should be reserved for people who are here legally. You have people on the street right now who are homeless, who are here legally and lawfully, he said. Can we answer how many illegals are in public housing in our state? Should we know that number? Because that's housing that could be for them, that they could have an opportunity. In Iowa, legislators are considering Republican-backed bills to require greater cooperation between local law enforcement and federal immigration officers and require state driver's licenses to display the holder's citizenship status. Governor Kim Reynolds has also floated a plan to make it harder for judges in criminal cases to release unauthorized immigrants on bond, potentially keeping them jailed, no matter how serious the criminal charges. Democratic states push back. In California, Democrats have proposed laws barring immigration officers from using state property, making it easier for people to sue federal immigration officers, and even blocking car rental companies from renting vehicles to immigration and customs enforcement officers. In Oregon, Democratic lawmakers are considering plans to withhold state grants or contracts with private companies assisting ICE, and clarifying that the state will withhold tax payments to the federal government if the White House blocks federal funding to state over its refusal to comply with Trump's demands. In Colorado, Democrats who control the state house are considering a raft of bills to restrict operations by ICE officers, including further limiting information sharing by state and local governments and barring enforcement at sensitive locations such as hospitals. What I'm hearing is people want us to do everything we can to stand strong against this agency and this administration, said first-generation Iranian-American State Representative Yara Zokai, a Colorado Democrat. Zokai is drafting legislation that would also ban ICE officers from ever becoming local or state police officers. She said she's been consulting with fellow legislative Democrats in other states to prepare model legislation in much the same way the White House has been working with Republicans. In any other year, such sweeping changes wouldn't have a chance of passing the state legislature, she said, but people are upset by what they are seeing as overreach by Trump's immigration enforcers. The state has immense power to take a stand against the federal government and to protect our constituents from the federal government, Zokai said, and it is because we have that power that Trump threatens to retaliate against us. Also contributing to this report was Vivian Jones, and Nashville, Tennessean. And over to our next reading, an analysis. Squeaker or tsunami? Three numbers could hold key to midterm elections. This was written by Susan Page. Big numbers and high stakes are riding on the ballot in November. 435 House seats, 35 Senate seats, 39 governorships, and the country's course for the final 2 years of President Donald Trump's term. Who will win? In math of the midterms, a handful of statistics can signal the odds of a squeaker or a tsunami, of a Democratic sweep, or the resilience of the Republican status quo. If we lose the midterms, you'll lose so many of the things that we are talking about, so many of the assets that we are talking about, so many of the tax cuts that we are talking about, and it would lead to very bad things. Trump told supporters at a rally in Iowa that kicked off his election year campaigning. We have got to win the midterms. Contrast to the president's warning with the confidence of House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York, we only need to net 3 seats, he told reporters on Capitol Hill. It's happening. Democrats are going to take back control of the House. And the only question is, what's the margin? 9 months before Election Day, time enough for things to change. Here are 3 key statistics that carry clues about November's outcome. Start with Trump's approval, 36%. That was the president's rating in the Associated Press, or NORC, survey taken February 5th to February 8th, the latest of the public polls considered most credible. The tepid measure of his political temperature was consistent with other respected pollsters, including a 37% approval rating in the Quinnipiac University poll from January 29th to February 2nd, and the 36% rating in the Gallup poll from December 1st to December 15th. That level of support, if it persists, would be a 7-decade low for a president at a midterm and a red alarm for the GOP. Trump won't be on the ballot, of course, but a president's popularity has consistently forecast how his party's candidates are going to fare. Midterms are not only elections, but also referenda on the White House, the prime opportunity for voters to weigh in on how they think the commander-in-chief is doing. At a retreat of House Republicans, Trump said that the consequences could be personal for him. You've got to win the midterms, because if we don't win the midterms, it's just going to be, they'll find a reason to impeach me. I'll get impeached, he lamented. He speaks with experience. When Democrats regained control of the House during the first term in 2018, they did impeach him twice. Some of those GOP representatives see their own peril ahead. 30 of them have already announced they won't run for re-election, some to retire and others to run for other offices. That's 14% of the GOP caucus, with more likely to follow. In comparison, 21 Democrats have said they won't run again. Since World War II, the president's party has lost an average of 25 seats in the midterms. Only twice the party has in power gained ground, in 1998 and 2002. In both cases, the president's approval was soaring into the 60s. But the only president with a midterm rating lower than Trump's current standing was Harry Truman in 1946, at 33%. That fall, the returns were brutal for his fellow Democrats. 55 lost their House seats. In 2006, when George W. Bush was at a dismissal as a dismal 38%, 30 fellow Republicans lost their seats. In Trump's first term, when his ratings was 41%, the GOP lost 40 seats. That said, the swing of dozens of seats has become increasingly difficult as the number of competitive districts has declined and political divisions have sharpened. The nonpartisan Cook Political Report with Amy Walter lists only 18 House seats as toss-ups, with Republicans in more peril than Democrats, and another 18 seats as leaning in one direction or the other. By the way, the flurry of redistricting schemes in Texas, California, and elsewhere to gerrymander congressional lines now looks as if it will end in a wash. That net number, close to zero. Watch economic angst, 57.3. That's the preliminary read for February from the University of Michigan's Authoritative Consumer Sentiment Survey. The benchmark of how consumers are feeling has sunk 20% since Trump took office again a year ago for the second time, reflecting continued concern about the economy now and pessimism about what's ahead. Created in the 1950s, the number typically rises during good economic times and bottoms out during recessions. Over the past half century, it hit an optimistic high of 111.3 in February 2000, near the peak of the longest economic expansion on record, and a low of 50 in June 2022, when inflation was spiking. The current measure is actually lower than that now among people who don't have stock portfolios. A bit of a bump in the ratings this month was fueled by more affluent Americans with money in the markets. Lower-income workers have seen slower wage growth, and more households are falling behind on their debts. Nearly 3 out of 4 Americans now describe economic conditions as only fair or poor. Assessments of Trump's handling of the economy, once a strength, is now a liability. Disapproval hit a record 59% in an NPR, PBS News, or Marius poll taken January 27th to January 30th. Most said Trump's signature tariffs had hurt. To the president's annoyance, surprisingly solid economic statistics have failed to persuade many Americans to adopt a rosier outlook. Last month, job growth was stronger than expected, and inflation was lower. I think we have the greatest economy actually ever in history, Trump declared with some hyperbole to Fox Business host Larry Kudlow. But the president acknowledged that voters remain stubbornly skeptical. I guess we have to sell that because we should win in a landslide and we'll do everything we can to do it. Trump has mocked the issue of affordability as a Democratic hoax and a con job. Some anxious Republicans have urged him to show more public displays of empathy. He's not the first president to discover that economic statistics don't always determine how Americans feel. asked George H.W. Bush, whose argument that the economy had turned the corner failed to win him a second term in 1992. He was defeated by Bill Clinton, running on a mantra that has become a political adage. It's the economy, stupid. Or Joe Biden, whose insistence that data showed the economy was strong despite a downbeat national mood reinforced a sense that he was out of touch. MAGA money, $304 million. For the GOP, cold cash is an encouraging number in a discouraging year. Begin with some basics. The Republican National Committee reporting having $95 million in the bank in January, while the Democratic National Committee now owes more money in loans than it has in the bank. The main GOP super PAC for Senate races, the Republican Senate Leadership Fund, has $100 million, close to triple the $36 million reported by the Democrats' Senate Majority PAC. Looming over it all is MAGA Inc., the lead pro-Trump super PAC with a stunning $304 million on hand. There is no clear Democratic counterpart to that. I am pleased to report that I have raised since the great presidential election of 2024 in various forms and political entities an excess of $1.5 billion, Trump announced without details in an after-midnight post on Truth Social last August. That immense war chest would be especially remarkable, amassed by a lame duck president. In the past, Trump hasn't always been willing to spend his money on other people's races, though in the midterms, during his first White House term, then 2018, his super PAC, America First Action, spent less than $30 million. This time, he may well want to save himself his financial firepower to play a role in the 2028 presidential election. But he could choose to deploy millions of dollars to defend vulnerable Republican incumbents, attack promising Democratic challengers, and financial ads that promote his leadership and warn of disastrous consequences if his opponents prevail. Would that be enough to counter his sagging approval and voters' economic angst? We may be about to find out. And over to our next article. Scientists ponder murder by frog toxin. Russian opposition leader's death reviewed. This was written by Dina Voiles-Pulver. A joint report alleging that a poison dart frog toxin has been linked to the death of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny rippled quickly around the globe among scientists. The allegations raise fresh questions about the circumstances of Navalny's 2024 death and about the origins of a highly unusual toxin. Poison dart frog species have long fascinated researchers and the public partly because of their diminutive size and striking color patterns and also because of the story surrounding the deadly toxins found on their bodies. Indigenous hunters, for example, use one type of dart frog poison on the tips isn't known to have been used to kill anyone. Kyle Summers, an emeritus biology professor at East Carolina University, told USA Today. The report released on February 14th by the United Kingdom, Germany, France, Sweden, and the Netherlands stated the governments were confident Navalny was poisoned based on the traces of epibatidine found in his body. Navalny, an attorney, had been imprisoned in Siberia when he died. The report noted the toxin is only found naturally in poison dart frogs in South America, not Russia. The governments didn't release toxicology reports, and the Russian government denied the allegations. Epibatidine intrigued researchers for decades and was once highly sought after as a potential analgesic many times before more powerful than morphine. It may be possible that a chemical laboratory thousands of miles from the tropical rainforest could have artificially reproduced the toxin, but many questions remain, Summers said. How did we learn about the toxin in poison dart frogs? John Daly, a biological chemist at the National Institute of Health, pioneered research on dart frogs over decades, tracing the origin of their poisons to their diets, according to Joe Schwartz, director of the McGill University Office for Science and Society. Enzymes in the frog's body turned the alkaloids in ants, small beetles, millipedes, and mites into toxins, Swartz wrote in an article first published in the Montreal Gazette. Daly identified epibatidine in a poison frog in Ecuador called Epipetobates tricolor. At first, researchers had high hopes for the poison. Although it's extremely toxic, they found it had a pain-killing effect 200 times more potent than morphine and might not be linked to addiction. The idea that epibatidine could be a potentially useful pharmaceutical tool as a painkiller really stimulated a lot of interest and motivation. Summers said, ultimately it could be incredibly profitable if they could make it work as a painkiller. Scientists were able to decode the toxin and chemically reproduce it, but they found the difference between a beneficial dose and a deadly dose was too narrow to be viable. Could deadly toxin reportedly found in Nalvani be man-made? Summers noted the statement from the government's do not make clear Nalvani's cause of death, but it's remarkable if they were able to identify the epibatidine in samples from his body. It would be unprecedented if Nalvani's death is attributed to the epibatidine toxin, said Roberto Marquez, an assistant professor in the Biological Sciences Department at Virginia Tech. Although some indigenous tribes in the rainforest were said to have used bacteroactrotoxin from dart frogs for hunting, scientists haven't found any evidence that epibatidine was ever used for that purpose. The bacteroactrotoxin was the only frog toxin well known to be used by humans, and it was used by indigenous Americans in some parts of Colombia, Marquis said. It would be very surprising if anyone tried to use the product as an experimental chemical to poison someone, Summers said. The statement from the United Kingdom and other governments said they would inform the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons of their findings that could indicate a violation of the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention. It was also said that the findings raised concerns that Russia had not yet destroyed all of its chemical weapons. What to know about colorful poison dart frog species? Found in the tropical rainforest in South America, the frog faced risks from habitat destruction and the exotic pet trade. More than 175 species have been identified. Dart frogs in captivity aren't generally toxic because they aren't fed the same diet as frogs in the wild. The researchers found colorful patterns on the frogs warn predators of danger, Summers said. They advertise the toxin so that predators know to avoid them, he added. The frogs have evolved to be resistant to the toxin. The bright colors are sometimes mimicked by non-poisonous frogs to convince predators they are deadly and by other poisonous frogs to join forces in warning predators away, said Summers, one of several scientists who have studied coloration among dart frogs for years. Color is also used in mate choice and competition, Yu Seng Yang, an assistant professor at the University of South Florida, told USA Today. Females usually prefer males that have the same color as their own, as well as brighter colors, and males are more aggressive than when the opponent is the same color and brighter. Many of the poison frog species are different from other frogs, which abandon their eggs to hatch on their own, Summers said. He and Yang described how the adults cooperate
to travel their tadpoles to smaller pools. The tadpoles will wiggle onto the male's back, and the male will go to a smaller pool, Summer said. Over a period of months, they will go back and visit the pool. Females lay eggs for the tadpoles to eat and survive, the scientist said. That kind of monogamous pairing is very unusual for frogs, Summer said. The behaviors for mating are likely acquired when tadpoles remember their mom's color when she is feeding them, Yang said. And when they grow up, they show bias toward the color that they remember.
And over to our next article. Musk says SpaceX now wants a self-growing city on the moon. This was written by Eric Legata. Elon Musk is putting his dream of colonizing on Mars on hold. Instead, the world's richest man said SpaceX, his commercial rocket company, will turn its attention a little closer to home, the moon. The news represents a significant shift for Musk, who founded SpaceX in 2002 with the stated goal of helping humanity reach Mars and make life multiplanetary. But the moon, where even NASA aims to return astronauts as early as 2028, appears to have become a much more feasible target destination for Musk, at least in the short term. SpaceX has already shifted focus to building a self-growing city on the moon, Musk said on February 8th in a post on social media site X, which he owns. The billionaire tech mogul added that setting up a sustained human presence on the moon is achievable in the next decade, or about half the time he projects it would take to get established on Mars. Here's everything to know about Musk's vision of setting up a lunar colony and the status of his plan for SpaceX to send humans to Mars. What is SpaceX? Does Elon Musk own it? SpaceX is the commercial spaceflight company that Elon Musk, the world's richest man, founded in 2002. Musk, a former close advisor of President Donald Trump, is also the chief executive of SpaceX. SpaceX Falcon 9, the most active rocket in the world, is used on a variety of missions, including deployments on the company's Starlink internet satellites from both Florida and California, with nearly 10,000 satellites in its growing orbital constellation. Starlink has become a lucrative part of Musk's business empire, serving millions of customers around the world. SpaceX also benefits from billions of dollars in Department of Defense contracts, providing launch services for classified satellites and other payloads. The Falcon 9 rocket also helps launch NASA's human spaceflight missions to the International Space Station. Where is SpaceX based in Texas? Starship launches from Starbase. Musk has often spoken about his vision of colonizing other worlds in our solar system to ensure humanity's survival in the event of an extinction-level event on Earth. And it's SpaceX gargantuan Starship that is the centerpiece of Musk's hope of sending humans further out into space than ever before. SpaceX, which has been launching the 400-foot Starship on a series of test flights since 2023 from its Starbase headquarters in South Texas, is preparing to debut a new, more powerful version of the rocket in March 2026. Will Starship send humans to Mars? In the years ahead, Starship is due to help NASA astronauts land on the moon under the U.S. Space Agency's Artemis program. That mission, Artemis 3, will occur in the years after NASA completes its upcoming Artemis 2 venture, which, as early as March, could send 4 astronauts on a 10-day trip circling the moon. The Starship is also the vehicle Musk's SpaceX has long been developing to transport the first humans to Mars. Musk has often reiterated his goal of launching a Starship rocket as early as 2026 on a pathfinding trip to Mars without a crew on board.
That timeline, by the end of the year, would coincide with an orbital alignment around the Sun that would shorten the journey between Earth and Mars.
And over to our next article, Savannah Guthrie opens up about her missing mother. Today's anchor shares pleas and new video. This was written by Brendan Morrow, Anna Kaufman, Ray Covarrubias Jr., and Helen Rummel. Savannah Guthrie is again speaking out about her mother's possible kidnapping after authorities released more details in Nancy Guthrie's case. In a new video shared by the Today anchor, she said, "It has been 2 weeks since our mom was taken, and I just want to come and say that we still have hope and we still believe. All I wanted to say is to whoever has her or knows where she is, that it's never too late," said Savannah Guthrie, 54. "You are not lost or alone, and it's never too late to do the right thing. And we are here." Nancy Guthrie, 84, has not been seen since January 31st, and the Pima County Sheriff's Department has said it believes she was taken from her home outside Tucson, Arizona. The case, which the FBI has called a kidnapping, involves a 5'9" or a 5'10" man with an average build, whom law enforcement has called a suspect. He was seen wearing a ski mask and a black 25-liter Ozark Trail hiker pack backpack, the FBI said. Authorities have confirmed the collection of DNA not belonging to Nancy Guthrie or her inner circle from the home, along with gloves that appear to match those worn by the masked man in Guthrie's doorbell camera video. Images and videos of the masked man shared by the FBI on February 10th appear to show him armed. Family's hour of desperation. The Guthrie family has posted several videos on social media over the past 2 weeks addressing Savannah Guthrie's followers and whoever may have abducted Nancy Guthrie. On February 12th, Savannah Guthrie shared a home video of her mother and sister, Annie, as well as a family photo of the siblings as children. The family began posting messages after several media outlets reported receiving purported ransom notes making demands of the family, which have not been verified, according to the FBI. One ransom note that was sent to the media included a deadline on February 5th and a second deadline of February 9th. On February 9th, the day of the second deadline, Savannah Guthrie posted a video on Instagram saying her family was in an hour of desperation. She urged fellow followers to help in the search for her mother by reporting anything suspicious they may see to law enforcement. "We believe our mom is still out there," she said. "We need your help. Law enforcement is working tirelessly around the clock, trying to bring her home, trying to find her. She was taken, and we don't know where." The Today host did not directly address the ransom notes in her February 9th video. 2 days earlier, she shared a separate video speaking directly to whoever took her mother. "We received your message, and we understand," Guthrie said, while sitting next to her brother, Cameron, and sister Annie. "We beg you now to return our mother to us so that we can celebrate with her. This is the only way we will have peace. This is very valuable to us, and we will pay." Authorities tap into tech. In an interview February 16th on Today, Pima County Sheriff Chris Nanos said, as authorities chased several leads and ran DNA evidence from gloves found on the Guthrie property, that his team was getting closer to a break. "We think we're getting there," he said. "We think we're getting closer." Authorities were working with Google and other tech companies to track down any footage of Guthrie's abductor. As local and federal authorities have scoured Guthrie's property and nearby areas for evidence, investigators are drawing on physical, digital, and biological tools. Authorities reportedly have used a device known as a signal sniffer, mounted on a law enforcement helicopter in an attempt to detect Nancy Guthrie's pacemaker signal, according to reports from Fox News and News Nation. The outlets reported that the device was attached to a sheriff's department's helicopter seen flying low over the Tucson area February 3rd. Kevin Smith, spokesperson for the FBI's Phoenix Field Office, declined to comment on whether investigators were using such a device. Gloves appear to match footage. On February 15th, the FBI confirmed to USA Today that gloves that appear to match the gloves of that subject in the surveillance video were found 2 miles away from Guthrie's home in a field near the side of the road and sent to a lab for testing. The gloves were sent to a private lab, and the FBI received preliminary results but was awaiting quality control and official confirmation before putting unknown male profile into its database. In comments on Today, journalist Tom Winter said the National DNA database consists of people who have been arrested or convicted of crimes, which accounts for only 6.5% to 7% of the population. The Pima County Sheriff's Department had confirmed several gloves have been located in its investigation, the closest of which were found about 2 miles from Guthrie's home. The FBI later elaborated that approximately 16 gloves had been collected near the home, most of which were searchers' gloves they discarded in various areas. Law enforcement has asked anyone with information to contact 1-800-CALL-FBI or tips.fbi.gov, the Pima County Sheriff's Department at 520-351-4900 or 888-CRIME. The FBI is offering a $100,000 reward for information leading to Guthrie's return or the arrest and conviction of anyone responsible for her disappearance. Brendan Morrow and Anna Kaufman wrote for USA Today. Ray Covarrubias Jr. and Helen Rummel write for the Arizona Republic. And also contributing to this report was Kimi Robinson and Anthony Rabellito. And over to our next article. Miners attempted to bet on Super Bowl 60. Age verification vendor busy before the game. This was written by Nick Pezenstadler. A widely used age verification vendor for sports betting sites watched in real time during Super Bowl 60 on February 8th as a horde of kids and teens attempted to create new betting accounts on sites such as DraftKings, Fanatics, and FanDuel. It was stunning. They were scaling the walls, said Rivka Gerwitz-Little, chief growth officer at SoCure, the know-your-customer and fraud provider used by most regulated sports betting sites and many banks. The company gave USA Today an exclusive look behind its data to show the scale of would-be underage bettors attempting to gain access to sports books. During the hours before and during the Super Bowl, Little said, the company detected attempts to manipulate birth dates at triple or more the usual rate. That peaked in a single hour on February 8th, she said. When the service stopped more than 50,000 miners from creating new betting accounts. Little said SoCure typically blocks more than 99% of illegal attempts, according to its internal audits. The data comes against the backdrop of a USA Today investigation that showed thousands of kids and teens had illegally wagered millions of dollars on regulated sports books and were caught in recent years. Most of the time, when the fraud is logged, the users face no more consequences than being blocked on the platforms. Kids use a variety of methods to evade age rules by giving fraudulent information. In some cases, they use a parent or other adult ID with or without their knowledge. The scale of underage wagering is hard to measure,
but a recent survey of 1,017 adolescent boys nationwide found 36% gambled in the last year. Super Bowl 60 drew about $1.7 billion in legal sports bets, and on February 8th, plus hundreds of millions risked in an event contracts with prediction markets. Mike Cook, head of fraud insights at SoSecure, said new account signups surge alongside the six pregame Super Bowl ads for sportsbooks almost to the minute. FanDuel's last call for football sports arrived just before kickoff. DraftKings and Fanatics advertised during the game itself. Cook said his team detected a variety of age manipulation, synthetic fraud, in which real, stolen, and made-up information is used to create a new identity fraud, and document fraud. In one instance, they detected the same government identification facial photo being used numerous times, tied to different users. Behind the scenes, the company cross-references user information against public records like phones and addresses, as well as personal data such as social security numbers and the maturity of digital footprints like emails. We saw age-washing attempts where kids pulling together pieces of information to try to get around our systems, Cook said. It gives you a view that minors are trying to scam the system and using increasingly sophisticated methods to get around them. The company had to spot the fraudulent applicants among a crush of new legal users. SoCure saw more than 2.5 million new signups on game day and more than 5.1 million the week of the Super Bowl. That included prediction, marketed, and online gaming customers. The Super Bowl was a pressure test of how identity detection tool can stand up to the volume, Little said. It shows that minors are relentlessly going to attempt to challenge the system, and they are a formidable force. Marketing for a top sports book floods the airwaves and casts a giant net for customers that critics say has lured high schoolers, college kids, as well as those legally allowed to bet. Experts worry that watching sports has become conflated with betting the lines. The latest information from the National Council on Problem Gambling shows adolescent problem gambling leads to a complex mix of criminal behavior, poor academic achievement, truancy, financial problems, depression, suicide, and substance abuse. Ahead of the Super Bowl, the authors of the study on underage gambling from Common Sense Media sent NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell an open letter seeking reforms. And a quick editor's note, USA Today company may earn revenue from its sports betting operators for audience referrals. These operators have no influence over newsroom decision or coverage. Terms apply. See the operator's full site for full conditions. If you are a loved one who has a known gambling problem, help is available. You can reach to the National Problem Gambling Helpline at 1-800-MY-RESET. Here are some resources in other states. Call 1-800-GAMBLER in New Jersey and Ohio, 1-800-522-4700 in Columbia, 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa, or 1-800-9-WITH-IT in Indiana. Must be 21 or older to gamble. And over to our next article. Teen who fought for father's release from ICE detention dies. Chicago teenager had soft tissue cancer. This was written by Tao Nguyen. A Chicago teenager who garnered national attention for fighting for her father's release after he was detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in 2025 has died, a family spokesperson said. Ophelia Giselle Torres Hidalgo, 16, died on February 13th from stage 4 alveolar rhabdomyosarcoma, according to a statement from the family spokesperson. Torres Hidalgo has been diagnosed with the rare and aggressive form of soft tissue cancer in December 2024. The teenager was undergoing cancer treatment and had been home visiting her family for the weekend when her father, Ruben Torres Maldonado, was arrested in October 2025 at a Home Depot store in suburban Chicago. A GoFundMe page set up for her father's states, for the family states. He was detained during the Trump administration's Operation Midway Blitz, a major immigration enforcement campaign that brought a surge of federal agents to the Chicago area. Following his arrest, Torres Hidalgo posted a video on social media calling for his release. She described her father as a hardworking immigrant who cared for her younger brother while she stayed at the hospital for treatment. My dad, like many other fathers, is a hardworking person who wakes up early in the morning and goes to work without complaining, thinking about his family, Torres Hidalgo said in the video. I find it so unfair that hardworking immigrant families are being targeted just because they were not born here. Torres Hidalgo successfully fought for her father's freedom, and an immigration judge in Chicago ruled 3 days before her death that her father was conditionally entitled to receive cancellation of removal due to the hardships his deportation would cause his children, who are U.S. citizens, according to the family spokesperson. The ruling provides Torres Maldonado with a path to obtaining lawful permanent residence and eventual U.S. citizenship, the statement said. Torres Hidalgo was present via Zoom at her father's hearing last week. Ophelia was heroic and brave in the face of ICE's detention and threatened deportation of her father, Kalman Resnick, Torres Maldonado's attorney, said in a statement. We mourn Ophelia's passing, and we hope that she will serve as a model for us for how to be courageous and to fight what is right to our last breaths. A steadfast, dedicated, and truly inspiring life. Torres Hidalgo was a junior at Lakeview High School in Chicago, according to the family's attorney. Private funeral arrangements have been made. The GoFundMe page, set up by Torres Hidalgo's in-home teacher, Valerie Wadicki, initially asked for funds to assist with Torres Maldonado's legal fees and to help the family while he's been being detained. In an update on February 15th, Wadicki said the fundraiser was adjusted to help with Torres Hidalgo's funeral arrangements. I am deeply saddened to share with you that Ophelia Torres has passed away, the GoFundMe page states. Thank you for your kindness in supporting this family during this difficult time. Thank you for respecting their privacy as they mourn this tremendous loss. Wadicki described Torres Hidalgo as bright, curious, and thoughtful. Wadicki said she had been working with Torres Hidalgo as her in-home teacher while the teenager was being treated for cancer. Through my time working with Ophelia, I have grown close to her family and have learned what a dedicated mother and a working, hardworking, and loving father she has, Wadicki noted. In a statement on February 15th, Chicago Mayor Brendan Johnson said the teenager led a steadfast, dedicated, and truly inspiring life. Today I join Chicagonians across our city in mourning Ophelia Torres, a young woman who fought for her father and her family in the face of a cruel, targeted campaign through which Donald Trump has sought to strip us the very humanity that defines our families and our communities, Johnson said. Judge ruled Chicago's teen's father was illegally detained. On October 18, 2025, Torres Maldonado was leaving a Home Depot store in Niles, a village bordering Chicago's far northwest side, after getting supplies for his job, according to the GoFundMe page. As he was leaving, he was detained by federal agents. ICE agents called out to him by name. He attempted to ignore them and got in his car and locked the door, according to the GoFundMe page.
That is when one of the four ICE agents started smashing the passenger side of his car in an attempt to get in. An ICE agent threatened Torres Maldonado with a gun, the GoFundMe page claims. Torres Maldonado then willingly exited the car and was arrested. At the time, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security told NBC Chicago that Torres Maldonado has been charged multiple times with driving without insurance, driving without a valid license, and speeding, and claimed he tried to flee in his vehicle. The Chicago Sun-Times reported that Torres Maldonado, a painter, entered the United States in 2003 and lived in Chicago with his partner of 20 years. A judge ruled on October 24, 2025, that Torres Maldonado was unlawfully detained, and he was later released on bond, according to the newspaper and NBC Chicago. And over to our next article. Trump's National Guard deployment isn't over. After drawdown, troops remain in three cities. This was written by Christopher Kahn. National Guard soldiers have fully withdrawn from Los Angeles, Chicago, and Portland, Oregon, military officials said, ending federalized troop operations in half of the cities where the Trump administration launched them last year. The troops completed their withdrawal as of January 21st, according to U.S. Northern Command, which noted the demobilization on its website. The White House did not immediately respond to a request for comment about the troops' departure, which was first reported by the Washington Post. President Trump announced in December that the soldiers would be leaving after the Supreme Court blocked his administration from sending troops to Chicago, ruling its justification insufficient. Trump has credited National Guard members with reducing crime rates, though crime was already trending down in cities where soldiers were deployed. "We are removing the National Guard from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Portland, despite the fact that crime has been greatly reduced by having these great patriots in those cities, and only by that fact," Trump said in a social media post in December, adding, "We will come back, perhaps in a much different and stronger form, when crime begins to soar again." The drawdown ends the controversial missions launched over the objections of state and local officials who responded with a series of legal challenges, several of which led to rulings that found the deployments unlawful. But while hundreds of National Guard soldiers have departed from the three U.S. cities, thousands remain in Washington, New Orleans, and Memphis, Tennessee, under the command of Republican governors or Trump himself. Here's what to know about the withdrawals and the ongoing deployments. National Guard troops federalized amid immigration push. Guard troops were first sent to Los Angeles in June following protests over aggressive immigration raids, marking the first time since the civil rights movement in the 1960s that a state's National Guard was federalized without a formal request from the governor. Over the next 6 months, the administration launched several deployments across the country. While the Los Angeles, Chicago, and Portland deployments stemmed from protests, the missions in Washington, Memphis, and New Orleans were tied to broader crime reduction efforts, though immigration advocates and attorneys in those cities also reported increased immigration raids. In Washington, troops were routinely seen picking up trash, laying mulch in tourist areas, and patrolling train platforms. In November, a gunman shot two National Guard troops near the White House, killing Army Spec Sarah Beckstorm and seriously injuring Air Force Staff Sergeant Andrew Wolf. Troops in Los Angeles, Chicago, and Portland were federalized under a Title X status, limiting them from engaging in law enforcement actions such as arrests or searches. Soldiers in Memphis and New Orleans, who remain under state control, have broader authority to detain people. Lawsuits hamper National Guard deployments. Every deployment except the one in New Orleans has faced significant legal challenges, with multiple judges ruling the mobilizations unlawful. On appeal, the Trump administration has received both temporary victories and losses. In December, a federal appeals court allowed National Guard troops to remain in Washington, reversing a lower court ruling that it had deemed it unlawful. The same month, the Supreme Court ruled against the administration's use of the National Guard, blocking it from sending troops to Chicago. At this preliminary stage, the government has failed to identify a source of authority that would allow the military to execute the laws in Illinois, the majority wrote in its brief opinion. The administration has appealed rulings by federal judges in Chicago and Oregon that deemed the deployments unconstitutional. Those appeals are pending. How long will the remaining deployments last? The roughly 350 soldiers deployed to New Orleans are expected to leave at the end of February, according to Louisiana state officials. Nearly 3,000 troops in Washington are expected to remain there through the end of the year. No withdrawal date has been set for the 1,500 Guard members in Memphis. The Tennessee Court of Appeals is expected to hear arguments in March on whether to sustain a lower court's order blocking the use of National Guard troops there. National Guard deployments cost almost $500 million last year. Trump's deployment of the military to American cities cost taxpayers nearly $500 million in 2025 and would cost more than $1.1 billion if continued for another year, according to a Congressional Budget Office estimate. The estimate found that Trump's deployments of soldiers to five U.S. cities, including Los Angeles and Washington, cost around $496 million. According to internal military budget information obtained by USA Today in September, the deployment of National Guard troops to Washington cost more than $1.8 million per day. The CBO analysis found that another year of the Washington deployments will cost roughly $55 million per month, or $660 million for the whole year. Also contributing to this report is Seibel Mayez-Osterman from USA Today and Brooke Muckerman from Memphis Commercial Appeal. And looking at the time, that's all the time I have for today. My name is Billy, and I've been reading you today's version of USA Today for the Talking Information Center. Have a wonderful day, and thank you for listening.